Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. Everybody knows the saying that there are only two constants in life, death and taxes. And my guest today certainly knows that, but don't worry, we won't be talking taxes. Jody Fannigan joined the family business in 1987 as one of three in the fifth generation to run the company. The sixth generation is now also working there. He was made a director in 1994 and then became managing director in 2013. Fannigan's is truly a family business established in 1819 and so has been providing excellence in funeral care to families in Dublin for two centuries, looking after one in every four funerals in the city. But it's not just one family business, as the group now encompasses Kirwan's, Nichols and Carnegie Funeral Homes, which combined run 11 funeral homes located throughout Dublin, employing almost 100 people. Their latest funeral home, located in Rathfarnham, opened in June 2018, is a 3,000 square foot premises which incorporates a state-of-the-art operations and logistics centre. This represents a significant investment in the future success of the company. But the keen sports fan listening will also know that Jody is well known for another reason, as his golfing CV is hugely impressive, boasting South and West of Ireland championships, two appearances for the GB and Ireland team in matches against Europe, and of course a Walker Cup appearance in 1995 with three match wins, including one against a certain Eldrick Woods, aka Tiger. This golfing prowess has continued in later life with success in both European and US Senior Amateur Opens, which will see him tee it up with the pros of the US Senior Open in 2024. I'm hoping for a nod at the role of caddy, but I'm told it's already taken. Such is life. Jody, you're very welcome to the podcast. I hope I got everything down there.
Thank you, Aidan. Yes, you've covered a lot of ground there. Yes, it'll be an interesting career, all right.
Let's just take a kind of a step back for a minute and think about, there has been huge consolidation in the Dublin market in funeral care over the last decade plus. You know, where does the landscape lie now relative to, say, people maybe thought about it 10, 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah, interesting. Because I've been in the funeral business for about 36-37 years now, and there have been big changes, there's no doubt. I think when I started, there would have been, I'd say, up to maybe 25-30 different funeral companies in Dublin. And there has been consolidation, certainly. We probably are in around 20-22 now. But there are three or four bigger groups, you know, apart from our own one, which has four brands. The Massey Certain Family, they've consolidated from six different companies into three or four now, and other companies sort of three or four. So, you know, I think there has been consolidation, but I think the way the funeral business changed, the funeral homes, a lot more around Dublin now, the facilities are much improved. The way funerals are run and what the public want now has changed with cremations. There have been lots of different changes within the funeral business. Mm. And we tend to actually react to what the public want rather than us dictating the way things should happen. Mm. So while, as I say, family businesses that have been synonymous with the funeral business haven't really changed, we've moved with I suppose, the way the clients have wanted us to operate and to get the best out of the funerals that we're trying to provide the service for.
You mentioned obviously the change in nature of the funerals, and obviously your new facility in Rathfarnham speaks to that. But at its core, this is still about dealing with people at potentially their lowest ebb. So the culture of the people that you employ and the culture of the business must be a key factor in all of this.
I think it's everything. It's everything in our business. I think it's a people's business. I think with technology and all, you know, and whatnot, you know, that can't run our business. You know, we're meeting people all the time. Yes, at their lowest ebb, we need people to talk to families. We need to, you know, we were the deceased person, our removal teams, our ambulance teams, our hearse, our drivers, our limousines, our embalming teams. You know, everything is about our people dealing with families, and that's the constant, and that's never going to change, you know. So about having the right people, we're extraordinarily lucky. We invest a lot of time in the people we have in our family business, and it pays off. I think, you know, I would say that's the biggest asset we have. People talk about our vehicles and our premises and stuff, but to be honest, you know, we're so lucky to have so many great people. And people, we always think that, you know, the funeral business may not be the sexiest business to get involved in, but people have, so in the last 10 years, we've had so many people who've moved direction in their career, and they've, you know, the hecticness of obviously their previous career, they've decided to change direction, and they've approached and said, listen, we've always kind of had an interest or whatnot, and I think it'd be suited to the business. And, you know, from chatting and interviewing them, and they've proved to be some of our best people who've moved direction in life, because they've got life experiences, and they know people, and they're so happy just to be helping people at a difficult time. And they have been brilliant addition to what we do. Not necessarily the people, you know, who've been coming from the start when I started, left college in UCT back in 87, there wasn't a huge amount of employment around. So a lot of people were leaving to go to London for jobs. So I drifted into the funeral business, and I've loved it for that long. But it wasn't where people were naturally drawn to. But of recent years, that's kind of changed. Mm. You know, we've got really good people in, and because we're a people's business.
It's become a far more complex business, though. Like, you look at it in terms of, like, back then people would have kind of assumed that, oh, look, it's the embalming and that's about it. But actually, there's a huge process now, and you know, I hate using the term, but it is kind of like an event management process, start to end, you know?
There's no doubt about that, and we use that kind of terminology a lot. And then, you know, it is an event over 3 or 4 days, and you have to get everything right for those 3 or 4 days, you know. And I suppose where you've got a church service and what, like, you know, it kind of like a wedding, you know, it's based around the church service part, but you've got normally 6 months, 9 months to arrange all that around the wedding. Whereas in a funeral, you've got to do that in 3 or 4 days. So we've a bigger operation of people who need to provide the service, that when we meet a family for the first time, they want X, Y, and Z. We need a big team around us to be able to deliver that for the 3 or 4 days. That's what we've promised, we've got to be able to deliver on. When I joined, you know, it was a lot simpler. Someone might pass away on a Monday afternoon, and we were going to the church on Tuesday evening, and then the funeral's next. It was all done in 48 hours. But I think what's changed is again, I think the embalming process has really transformed the funeral business, not just for us, but for everybody, whereby now we're able to, people take an extra day, we're now be able to, with the amount, to present a deceased person much better, in a much better way, so that their last memory is a very much more positive one, but in good surroundings of a good funeral home, with nice surroundings, and people just appreciate that bit. And then I think the extra day has been beneficial, where it's not over in 40 days in a blink of an eye, you know, and that kind of tended to happen because we didn't have the expertise 40 years ago to be able to have the presentation to the sounds we do have today.
Yeah. There is a delicate balance, though, isn't it? Because ultimately, there's the business side of it, but you don't want the person, you still want the family to feel it's a personal experience, if you know what I mean. Like, that, you know, you can be business-like, but you still have to be personal.
You're absolutely right, and that's key. And, you know, when you're in front of a family and talking about what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 days, you know, it's important that the family think that, or don't, not necessarily are aware that we might have 6 or 7 or 8 different funerals that day, but that also then behind the scenes we have a team looking after it, minding the business part of it.
Yes.
Absolutely. And you know, that the families feel that they're the most important people, and they are. But we have a team behind the scenes who look after the finance bit and all behind the scenes, and obviously that's very important. And, you know, I suppose the stories I hear from the family, and, you know, back in my dad's day, they were really good front of house people and stuff, but they didn't have the backup. And they, you know, finance wasn't that positive, and, you know, they were in, you know, difficulties at times. But now we're able to do both. We have the business ends needs being looked after in the background, but being front facing with the families as well.
The Vanagon Group, as I said, is the result of a few mergers and takeovers. So, you know, as you've gone through that process, what was the difference between, and I suppose it's particularly the case given the legacy of Vanagon's the core bit, right, in that it has developed its own culture in a very organic way, but then you start taking over other companies and what was the approach to blending those cultures as you went along?
Yeah, and you know, I think that's the beauty of being a family business. We're not a PLC. We didn't actually go out aggressively looking to have to grow, or, you know, being compelled to grow and have a certain percentage growth you needed every year. You know, we back in 1987, I think it was when actually Mr. Edward Nichols approached us, because he was coming near retirement, and none of his family were coming into the business, and he approached us to see would we be interested in buying him, and that happened and it went very well. And then through word of mouth, Mr. Nichols spoke to a colleague of his, Mr. Carnegie, and said, listen, you're coming to retirement, have you anybody in your family coming? No, I don't. Well, listen, go and talk to Mr. Vanagon, they've treated me really well. And again, we were approached, and that went very successfully. And I think
no,
we were
hostile
quite similar.
Takeovers.
No, it wasn't hostile, it wasn't aggressive, but actually they both, the person individuals, they had a love for the funeral business, and just they had a similar culture to ours. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't, not just say if anybody had approached us, we would have just said yes, because it's another funeral business. But I think they had a very good background and culture in the business, and they stayed in it, stayed with us on a part-time basis. And then actually the Kerwin family were selling back in 1995 or 6, I think it was, and there was a possibility that a big company in America might have bought them, but we happened to approach them, and they said, well, they prefer to deal with us. And again, because word of mouth, you treat people well, things come back to you. And again, they are such a fine family, the Kerwins. They had that funeral culture. They had gone back many, many years. They were actually 100 years this year, Kerwins. So it's that ethos and culture of, you know, of looking after families and being inculcated into the funeral business that attracted us. And actually, we haven't had grown since then, as in we haven't had to merge with any other family business, and they're all doing their own thing, and that's fine, but we haven't been aggressive, you know, and it's not something we're always looking for the right fit.
Yeah.
If it happens or comes upon us, and we're open to all the time, but you know, we've been lucky with the culture of the three family businesses we've been merging with, and it's been a great success.
And is it a very tight industry in Ireland? Like, does every, you all know each other, and because from memory, it used to be quite, even within Dublin, quite regional within Dublin. Everybody had their patch, so to speak.
And to a degree, but again, that's kind of changed, you know. Right. Others have encroached on each other's patch, and that's the nature. It's good, it's positive, it's competitive, but we've all actually, everyone's had to up their game. Now everyone's got good vehicles, got good funeral homes, got very presentable facilities, good people work for them. So everyone's actually, a rising tide has brought everybody up. Then there's been new entrants to the market. There are no barriers to joining. Mm-hmm. There's no licenses or minimum requirement. Anybody can open a shop down the road, and many individuals have done that. But, you know, while we're so we are competitive with each other, you know, if someone's in trouble, we help out.
Right.
We do know, I don't know them all now, but we know a lot of each other.
Right.
But we do help out,
right.
And we interhire if we're very busy and we need to have an additional hearse. We interhire. We have a personal relationship with them.
Okay,
but my God, it's still very competitive. Let me tell you.
let's switch and talk to intergenerational businesses, right? And in particular, the conflicts that come from one generation to the next. And what makes me fascinated about Vanagon's is because it is a sixth generation now, right? Typically, when I talk to intergenerational businesses, it's the first generation passing to the second, all right? And I'm talking to maybe the second or something like that. But in fact, we've got five changes now that we can go through. Does that intergenerational change ever get any easier? And B, are there, would you think the transfer of ownership lessons have been learned at each step?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and you know, I don't know what the secrets of our success is. But, you know, that we're still here now. I'm part of the fifth generation, and we're lucky that we have some of the sixth generation now working with us. So you know, to get to the fifth generation for when I started, and we, you know, we're over 200 years now, and we had a bicentenary in 2019, and we've done a family book and whatnot, and some of the histories throughout that. But and we've been in the funeral business for over that in some way, shape, or form. You started making coffins and whatnot, and then we moved into the undertaking funeral directing business, but sort of kind of ended up in the fourth generation, when really just was my grandfather on his own.
Okay.
Because there weren't that many family in the business, and my grandfather was on his own, so he didn't have siblings to deal with that, you know, they're vying for shareholding or yeah. who wanted to be the boss, whatever. So effectively, it was like starting again.
Okay.
But it wasn't. But it was like that. And then my father and his two brothers came into the business, so that was like a second generation, but it was the fourth. And then, as it happens, there was one from each of those brothers came in, which was Alan Fannigan, David Fannigan, and myself.
Right.
So, you know, you hear all the stories of the intergenerational families and the difficulty and you know, I suppose it is not easy. It's not easy. We're all different. We are. Gosh, the three of us in this generation are so different. But maybe because we are different, we see each other. It works.
Yes.
But I think also what happened was we were also naturally just slightly of a different age. You know, David he is sort of 12 years older than I, and then he's 4 years younger than Alan. So we all weren't wanting to be the boss at the same time. There was a natural
progression.
Alan did it for 25 years, David had it for 5, and then I did it for 9. So if you're all the exact same age, I'm sure there might have been a little bit more friction whereby, no, I want to be us, or, you know, he's the boss and whatnot. But you need a lot of patience, you know, and yes, we've had our moments, there's no doubt about it. But I think because we're 200 years, there's a huge sense of an onus of there's something bigger than just us, and we're trying to keep it going because of its longevity and success, and that you're trying to make it a little bit better for a while and maybe pass it or give the opportunity to pass it on to the next generation. So there was a bigger sense of there's something bigger than just maybe the three of us.
Right.
I kind of get that feeling.
Yeah.
Not really expressly said maybe between us, but I kind of get that feeling, you know, and maybe we worked with our fathers for a period. And you kind of have a huge respect for the generation before us. And there's a bit of that as well. And now it's really nice to see Alan's son and Robert and David's son, David Jr. He's just joined us 1 month ago. So that's all very exciting. Mm. And mine are younger, so who knows about my one. But that, the fact that we've two strands of our three families of the sixth generation, I think that puts us in good stead for the next 10, 20, 30 years at least.
Yeah.
So,
and those handovers of the baton, you know, you said that the three fathers stayed very much in, and did they remain a very strong sounding board for the three of you as you came through?
Yeah, they did. They did. And unfortunately, Alan's dad died early when he was 50. And then John did. And, he was a great example. And he was a stickler for detail. And that was passed down through to Alan and David. I didn't get to work with him. And then my dad, we were lucky that he just loved working in the business. Mm-hmm. And he was a great people's person. He was an ambassador. Once he sort of post 60, when he semi-retired, he kind of retired for 2 weeks, went at home, and mum sent him back out 2 weeks later. And you hear lots of those stories.
I've heard lots of those stories, exactly.
He certainly was no use at home, that's for sure. So, but once he had made a decision to go back in, gosh, he loved it. And he kept working till... He kept going to funerals till he was about 86 years of age. So, you know, he just loved it. So, and that has to rub off on you. And you see the commitment and the love of it. And I think all the staff loved having him around. You know, and everyone knew him around Dublin. He was very sporty, and he all the different clubs. And And then the trade, people knew him for being around so long. So we've been very fortunate to have that example, without doubt.
Yeah. And do you think they'd be stunned or even recognise the business in terms of what it's... The business of a funeral today relative to what they thought a funeral was?
Oh, my goodness, you're absolutely right. And I think that was one of the good things, was that, you know... the business changed fundamentally. When Dad started, you know... The business was a coffin, a hearse, an order of the grave. And that was it.
Yeah.
That really was it. And there were tough times in Dublin and, you know, people had a lot of money. But as we saw the need to progress and improve the service, he was really supportive. He just said, guys, if you think that's going to work, go do it. I'll do my thing. I'll be an ambassador for the family, and I'll support, and I'll go to funerals and meet people. All that. You guys run it. You're going to do the work. You say you need to do X, Y, Z. We'll spend money. Go and do it,
right.
And I'll support it. You know, at the board table, I support it. You go and do it.
Yeah.
And it kind of worked.
And as you guys move to the side, and the next generation comes too, is that in the back of your mind? Is the saying, I need to be the same as that. I need to be supportive, but not, if you will, a pushover, you know?
Yeah, good. That's a good question, because we're finding that now, and it's such positive, because you're getting new views in, which is you need around management and the board table. And Robert and David, the new generation is the technology stuff and the branding stuff and the PR and the marketing and all kinds of stuff. So it's a very conservative business we're in slightly, and we'd be very cautious and wouldn't like to put ourselves out there too much, but it's opening our eyes all the time, and the new voices of what they have to deliver. I mean, David Fanning Jr., he was working Google for 10 years, so he could work with young people. He sees what the young people, the way they think and all that, and so it remains to see where we go. But you know, and branding has always been one of the things that we've kind of grappling with, because we've got four family brand names, and while the Fannigan family would be the overall holding company. So how that evolves over, you know, the next 10, 20, 15 years will be very interesting to see how it goes. But we have to be supportive of it, because it'll be their business coming in due course.
What about regional expansion? Because it's always been and you look at the funeral business in general, it tends to be, you know, you never got a Dublin family operating in Cork or Galway or anywhere else. You never got a Cork family operating in Limerick. It has always maintained a very strong regional location, and nobody kind of steps outside the county. Is do you think that continues, or as we look at the demands being placed on more and more small places to have the full suite of offering, means they just can't do it and they have to be part of a bigger group?
So that is an interesting dynamic, and it's something not necessarily the opportunities haven't arisen, but there's certainly between Dublin and the cities, there's a few differences, and then there's the towns, and then there's the villages. And, you know, I think the towns and villages around Ireland, everyone normally, each, they have their own funeral director, and they might only do 25 or 50 funerals a year, but they know the people. They know the people, and that's the difference. And I think, you know, possibly, you know, Limerick, Galway, Cork and whatnot, you know, again, you know, who knows? But people, we would always wonder, you know, would the public be saying, oh, you know that they're owned by the lads up in Dublin, and it's a big investment and risk, where, because people, it's still Ireland small. We might be, they say Ireland's a village, a town, and it is. And people, they like to deal with the people they know, not with the people maybe up in Dublin. And that's, we steered away from it. We haven't been aggressive looking for that. And we think probably there's a reason behind that.
I suppose, and it's something you said a few seconds ago about being custodians of the business. Each generation is a custodian and part of a bigger thing. You know, how do you feel, and the two others in this fifth generation maybe, about what you've done already in the company? Like if you were to mark the copybook today and look back at the time, how do you feel you've done the company? And, you know, it's that classic idea, is it in a better place as you leave than when you got it? Because the industry is a very different place. So, you know, there is always that to consider.
Yeah. you know, you'd like to think so. Maybe the figures say yes, we have grown slowly, surely. It's a bigger place. We've big more branches throughout the city, and I think the service and the quality of what we've done has improved. I don't think we haven't taken too much risk to exponentially grow. We haven't exposed ourselves with debt and whatnot. And you've got to be very careful. And you know the way, you know, we've had upturns, downturns financially in the country. So I think we've plowed a steady line, and we've grown steadily, cautiously, but positively. You know, I think we'd like to think we've put it in a little better place than for the next generation, without boasting about it or anything. But I think that, you know, we haven't gone backwards, we haven't stood still, we haven't rested on our laurels, that's for sure. And the fact that we're, you know, we're still all involved in the business, we're fully invested. You know, David and Alan, while they're semi-retired, they're still work as ambassadors. They go to church most days because a lot of people know them. And so we're not in it for the short term, you know, definitely.
I suppose a typical question I ask for business owners and things like that is, what, you know, to what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for you? But if I change it slightly and say, to what extent has fear of screwing up the legacy been a driving force, which is probably more important in this business given the many generations?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt. I get that feeling. I'm very conscious of it. I think even in my sporting bits, you know, and you know, when you go out and you put yourself out there, be it in business or sport and whatnot, I find fear of failure, not wanting to lose, you know, that drives you on for a pride of performance. And I think in the funeral business, you have to show that every day with every family you're taking into your care or helping. You know, there is a huge responsibility on a sort of subjective with family, but also for our own family from within, and wanting to be a good example and a leader, and you know, protecting the culture. You know, that does drive you on, and not try to let standards drop. And I think that's been big, certainly for me.
Yeah,
that fear of failure. You know, you like to think you keep things going.
And then. Moving on from that, you know, how important on a day-to-day basis is having that clarity of purpose? You know, that you know, you want to grow the business, but you can't risk the business, I suppose, is the balance.
That's right. And I think, you know, people around the board table, you know, we've been very fortunate. We've not, you know, we were so conservative at Insular for so long, but, you know, not making too many mistakes, but we've been lucky. We've had a number of very good non-executive directors who've been independent and come in with an interesting voice. And, you know, just it's about making the right decisions cautiously, but, you know, trying to be progressive at the same time. And you can't stay the same. And I think gradually we've made improvements like that over the years, which has been very successful.
What skills do you think you've brought from the golf course to the business?
I think, oh my goodness, that's a good question. I think that, you know, as a golfer, it's next hole up, next shot up. You know, your day deliver today. Deliver the service, what we, Excellence and Funeral, we try to do. Tomorrow you got to go and do it again. Yeah. And if things go wrong, small bits do happen and all that kind of stuff, you move on, you go and try to improve and next shot up, next hole up, thinking ahead of how can we do it better, and keep delivering the service.
And consistency.
Yeah. Certainly in sport you need to do that, and same in our business.
And do you think, and there's a bigger, an interesting segue in, is to say, you know, as you've gotten bigger, there's always the threat or the risk that the level of customer service falls. And as going back to the same thing, that everybody thinks the funeral they're at today for their family is the only funeral that you're doing, and you have to convince them of that, but you may have to do that 30 times in a day, right?
Maybe not in a day, but yeah, you know, in a week you might. But no, but funny enough, I think that because of our scale and because we are big, I think the fact that we have the backup to be able to deliver it. We have great people in all the different sections. I think it's a smaller operation in a town or a village around Ireland. There's one person doing everything, and there's a lot of pressure on that one person to do lots of different things. Whereas us having a, you know, a funeral arranging team, a removal team, and a embalming team, and a hearse limousine driving team, we've got great support. We know we can deliver what we're saying or promising, which is quite comforting, actually. Rather than having that, you know, because the numbers we do, rather than that being an issue for us, actually, it's because we have a really good team focused on their particular skill.
And then do you obsess about the small things?
We do. We do. And that was always drummed into us by certainly my father and his brothers and before them. And that's the kind of thing we've tried to inculcate with our staff. And we're always checking and double checking everything all the time. And we're a bit neurotic in that regard, but it's so very important.
Yeah, because it all adds up. It all adds up.
Small things or big things.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
in our
particularly,
business.
It'll be the small things that somebody will upset somebody on the day of a funeral.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And but you know, that's we're kind of used to it. But you have to keep on it.
Yeah. I'm going to throw you a bit of a shank now, or a pull hook, right? A pull hook. I'm going to try it now. How come you never joined the professional golf ranks? You certainly had the game for it. From what I'm told, you have, and I've independently reviewed this from several different sources, and I was told definitely you would have had. But so why not?
So I don't know how to. Anyway, I was a rugby player all my sort of in my teenage years. Mm-hmm. I loved rugby. Rugby's my first love, and I played golf for 3 months in the summer, and I love like golf too. But I love the team bit and the team sport and whatnot. Played rugby in college and played golf as well, but I knew I hadn't got sort of all the skills. You know, I wasn't big, strong enough, quick enough, physical enough in the rugby and all that kind of stuff. That was fine. The golf was a hobby, and then just kind of it all happened in 1 year. Sort of I played really well 1 year, and I kind of got Leinster and then Ireland and blah, blah, blah. And so I played for Ireland for about 7 or 8 years, and you start to be quite successful. You know, you beat a lot of players who do turn pro, and you know, does it go into your mind as a possibility, as a career ahead? But I came late to it. Most people who turn pro at 20, 21, 22. And I hadn't even played for Ireland at that stage. Mm-hmm. So when I started to play, you know, for Ireland, I was 24, 25. I had a job, then I had a mortgage, and then I got married. And so when I started to play, when I played Walker Cup that 1 year, I was 30 years of age. It was very late in my golfing career, and it's very unusual for people who've got a mortgage and a job to leave that, to go on tour on your own, with a wife at home, and then we had a family, you know. It's very difficult to do that and change
it's a
direction.
Tough existence on
now,
the tour.
That's one reason. That's one reason. The other reason, you know, and as I never won a stroke play event. I wasn't a stroke play. I was good. I was solid, but I was good match player. A lot of my stuff was match play. And I remember, I'll never forget it, we were playing Walker Cup in 95. And then about a month later, Padraig had gone to tour school, Padraig Harrington, and he got his card. And whatnot, and we met him in January and whatnot, and he was just starting to go and play in the professional tournaments. I said, "Pork, you know, tour school, all the bits, do you think I might have been able to get through?" And he said, "Don't think so. You weren't good enough at that time, a stroke player.
Okay.
I didn't shoot low scores. You need to be able to shoot low. And I was good on tough courses, but I wasn't good where you needed to shoot 66, 65.
Okay.
But you know what? That's just probably maybe stating a fact that I hadn't won stroke play event. But to turn pro, it had to be deep in your heart.
Yeah.
I think if you look at all the successful players, they just loved
it. It's in the DNA.
They just loved it.
Yeah.
And how you cope with out and tour, that's another thing. But I think, as I say, when you've got a job, a mortgage, and a married life, I think it's a whole different ballgame to go and change direction late in your career, 30, 31. Mm. I think that's probably very rare that people do that successfully.
Switching back to the business, hire talent or develop within, from within, when it comes to running the business?
Bit of both. Bit of both. I think, you know, the hiring bit, you know, when you're hiring, you're trying to, no matter how many interviews and meeting people, you're never quite sure of the caliber and the culture of somebody or the real DNA of somebody until you experience working with them. Whereas when you have worked from within and you see what's inside someone's soul, I think, and, you know, the talent development within, you know, can pay off in dividends because they get they love the business if they want to improve as well. So a bit of both, I would say. We've been extraordinarily lucky.
Yeah. And is it easier, I think, now today to hire people into the business because it's such a diverse skill sets now required in it than maybe was 20, 30 years ago when people kind of viewed it as the embalmer and being, that's about it, you know?
Yes, I think there might be the sort of the perception out there that may not be the sort of sexiest job to be involved in, but I think now more people are applying and are interested in our business. And I think because it doesn't have a tabooish type of tag to the funeral business now, because of the way things are done in such a professional manner and such good people in it, and there's a proper career in it now. It might have been the last chance saloon for people 50 years ago type thing. I think it's a very attractive career and whatnot.
Do you find a lot of people coming into it as a second career?
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. Absolutely. And they've had great life experiences. And I think they're people who are so much more suited to the business when they've had that life skills behind them.
What's the hardest job as MD? What's the hardest part of the job?
I think the hardest bit, I think, is the sleeping at night with when you're the ultimate responsibility, you know. And in our business, there's so many things, moving parts to every day, to every week, to every month, to every year. There's so many moving parts, different people, that is lots to keep on top of. And I think there's that kind of in the back of your head all the time of the worry and what, you know, keeping tomorrow and what's coming next down the tracks next week. So that never stops. I think, you know, we giving people bad news is tough. But I'm used to, you know, helping families and, you know, they're going through a really tough time, but I'm trying to help them, and it's rewarding when you have helped people for 3 or 4 days. So that's actually part of what I do, is a good part. But
and do you get back onto the shop floor a lot?
You do. Well, I'm back now. I stood down as MD 2 years ago, nearly now, and so I'm out there now, more back in line with the funerals every day.
Right. What would you say you've learned from other executives or other companies that you've come across over the years?
I think you get, you know, meeting various interesting people, you get small snippets of how they've dealt with certain situations. I think we've only done it late in our last 10 years, getting independent different views, getting people inside, getting experts from outside coming in to give a different voice at a board table. I think that as we've got bigger, advice from people that, you know, you can't do everything. Try and professionalise the business where we 30, 40 years ago would have tried to do everything ourselves.
Be jack of all trades.
Correct.
Yeah.
But now the funeral directors look after the funerals, and we have, you know, really great people who look after HR, finance, independent chair on our board.
Lots of different businesses now. That's
the point. Yeah, that's exactly. Business has
changed.
They
are professional services. Yeah. You know, I think that's probably been the biggest change in the funeral business has been they are now professional businesses. It's a professional services business.
Exactly.
And it has to be run like any other.
You can't wing it anymore.
Yeah.
You can't employ people like the way you used to, you know, and or treat people the way it might have been acceptable for 50 years ago. So everything's changed, and I think getting professional people in, experts at what they do, has been brilliant for us.
What percentage of the success is due to luck and what's down to hard work? And we'll talk your golf career, and then we'll talk the funeral career as well.
Sporting wise, golf and whatever I did sporting, you know, I was lucky. I came up in a was brought up in a sporting family, parents drove us towards all the different sports, and I played everything, and I was reasonably good at lots, and I was, so I had a little bit of talent in there, but that only gets you so far. You know, you have to work. You have to work at it. But again, I liked doing that. So for me, it wasn't work.
You know,
I loved the bits of going out, hitting balls on your own, and trying to find a way to make it kind of happen. And but I found peace in that. I'm very happy to do that. You know, I didn't have to do it for like a professional, but I love spending my time trying to improve, be it the long game, short game, putting all that. So, you know, talent only gets you so far, and you must devote time. So I won't say work at it. You must devote time to it, because as I say, it didn't feel like work because I like doing it.
And the business,
the
side.
The business. I would, you know, the funeral business is it's 24/7. They talk about that, but it's 364 and a half days a year. And you know, with your names above the door, there's no doubt you have to, you put in more hours. You must be around. You know, we're not absentee employers.
Yeah.
We're on the ground, and. So you always need a little bit of luck along the way, but I think, you know, we've been present, and that's been the main part behind where we are.
What advice would you give your younger self today, or young people in general today?
I think balance. Everything's a balance.
Okay.
Don't get stuck on one thing. You know, keep moving. Keep doing different things. You got to have different interests, and you know, I know. People talk about having to progress in the career. You know, if you feel you might have to work 10, 12-hour days and all that. And there might be small, but I think you must have lots of different interests if you can. Be it a sporting one having other interests, movies, sports, books, you name it, music, whatever it is, a few strings to your bows. And then you have different times to do different things. I think a balance to your life is key. Right.
Switching back to the golf for one last question. Who's the best amateur and pro golfer you've ever seen?
Obviously, you know, I was lucky enough to play opposite Tiger Woods when he was 20 years of age playing the Walker Cup. Now, you know, again, lucky that he didn't have his best day playing foursomes with John Harris, and I was playing foursomes with Podrick. So, you know, he ultimately proved to be the best player, probably the best golfer of all time. As they say, Jack, probably the greatest champion of all time. But, you know, on that wet, windy day in Portcawl, I didn't get to see him in his very best. Yes. So as regards the best amateur I've played with as an amateur, I would say Sergio Garcia was probably the most talented young kid I've ever seen. He had it all. He's brilliant. Ball striker, I think Darren Clark was the best ball striker I played with as an amateur. He was magnificent. Sergio had it all. The short game, all, everything. Professional golfer that I've played with. You know, and I suppose I wouldn't have played, you know, I was lucky enough to play in the Lynx Golf Society with Christy O'Connor Sr. Again, he was in his mid-60s, but he was still wonderful to play with. Podrick's just the best. Podrick's is just sort of, what a great man, what a great sportsman, what a great golfer. He's so interesting, and I love his drive. His, you know, he's still at it, and he still wants to get better for next year. So, because I never got to play with Tiger, you know, as a pro, I never got to play with a lot of the greats, or Rory, or, you know, but, you know, playing 18 holes with Podrick is still as interesting as it ever was. He's just so good.
I won't disagree with you there. Now, the final question book comes out. Don't have a clue what's in it, so keep our fingers crossed. Oh, right. If you were to change role in your own business, what role would you take on and why?
Okay. I think... It might not be that interesting an answer, but I think I was in college in UCD, and I did economics and politics, and I always kind of liked the numbers. And I think if I wasn't to being front of house funeral director, I might have tended to go down the route of accountancy and whatnot. And I think maybe our accounts department was probably where I might have ended up if it wasn't front of house funeral directing. I always liked figures and numbers, and I wasn't an A-lister maths by any means, but... So I always have an interest in that section, I suppose. I definitely wouldn't have been an embalmer. It's just not my thing. And I'm 37 years in the business now, and the embalming room is still one that I try to avoid if I can. I've successfully kept away from it pretty much. But listen, it's a great business. I've a bit of experience in all the sectors in it, obviously, but I think if you, as I say, to answer the question, I might be a figures man if it wasn't to be what I currently do.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Jody Flanagan, for joining me today. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.